people are still going to keep moving to Texas and Florida, and they're going to keep renting because it's very hard to buy a home right now. And I don't see that changing materially because I do think we're in a higher for longer interest rate environment. So people can't afford the same mortgage that they could prior. That's going to be a tailwind for multifamily rentals. I think a lot of household formation is going to get forced to go into rental.
Welcome to Investing in the US, a podcast for real estate investors, business owners, and aspiring entrepreneurs looking to grow their wealth by investing in US real estate. I'm your host, Reid Goossens, and so far, I've acquired over $800 million worth of investments on various properties across the United States. On this podcast, I interview go-getters, risk takers, and the best in the business to learn more about their investment journey and the cutting-edge strategies they are applying towards building a legacy. For more on growing your own wealth and by investing in the US, visit www.reidgoossens.com. On the show, the pleasure of speaking with Dan Finch. Now, Dan has nearly two decades of experience in transacting and operating real estate and serves as the CEO of ATX Acquisitions, a real estate private equity firm with a track record of transacting over $2 billion of AUM assets under management, and ResProp, a property management firm that operates 10,000 apartment units. Now, Dan is the managing partner at Rex, a venture that disrupts real estate with technology products that empower people. And Dan lives in Austin, Texas. So a bit of a mouthful, all of that. Dan, what else don't you do, mate? But enough out of me. Let's get him out of here. Welcome to the show, big fella.
No, I love it, man. I love your style, Reid, and listened to a couple pods and really big fan, and look forward to getting into it.
Mate, me as well. Before we do get into it, ResProp,
yeah.
Did you own a bunch of stuff in Austin that we might have bought off you? I was trying to think who, because you guys based out of Florida, right? Or you were based out of Florida?
Yeah, we were originally. So that firm that bought $2 billion of assets, that was between 2011 and 2019. That was all Florida and Texas, but it started off in Tampa, okay. St. Pete.
I can't remember what the name was it called, but it was the Baxter at Westwood, which is up in. Which used to be called something at Westwood, okay. that I think you guys owned. We bought a few, you know, my former business partner and I made a killing on that deal. But 350 units up in Northeast Austin, near Cedar Park, in the Westwood High School District.
Well, our firm on the investment side never owned that. So ResProp is a third party shop now. So it's an affiliate company of ATX. So it was kind of. Its origin story is that it was born out of that vertically integrated shop that we built back in 2011. Now, when we pivoted and we sold $1.5 billion of the $2 billion, we actually grew back up our property management team to become a third-party shop, which is really actually hard to do. And so you might have bought an owner that was using us as management. Yeah,
because your name's been around for a while. But I'm going completely off script right now. So let's get back to the script. And this is going to love to riff. But rewind the clock and tell me how you made your first ever dollar as a kid.
I love the question. I was a scrappy, in my neighborhood, I would do lawn mowing. It was probably like 10 or 11, or just like if anyone needed to shovel their walk. And I don't miss snow, by the way. So I'm in Austin, Texas, but I don't see snow ever really. But yeah, that's how I do it. Just probably like doing neighborhood jobs. And then eventually I started working with my dad on weekends sometimes. He was a painter. So he was like a union painter, but on the weekends he would do like side hustle jobs, and I would just go and make a mess of things, but get paid for it. You know,
where'd you grow up? You mentioned snow, so clearly not in Austin.
Not in Austin. No, I grew up in New York. I was born in the city, Bronx, and I was raised upstate, which is like the Hudson Valley area, still New York City metro, but more suburban. It was a great place to grow up.
Nice. Yeah, I love it. Like, when'd you move to Austin?
Well, by way of many different other paths, but I was in Tampa for a while, scaling out that company. Then I was in Austin between 2016 and 2018, moved out to Bellevue, Washington for a couple of years as we launched into some technology initiatives. And then we came back to Austin during COVID because the West Coast was essentially like shut down right away, as you know, being in LA. And almost immediately, like, I bought my house here in August of 2020, and I've never looked back, and I love Austin.
Awesome stuff. Well, look, let's walk us through your journey of getting into the real estate space, because not everyone is just born with 15 years worth of experience. So did you have a corporate career before making the jump into, you know, what the platforms that you've built? And we'll get into those in a minute.
Yeah, I feel very blessed in how it all transpired. But, you know, like I mentioned, when I moved upstate in New York to my new home in this suburban area, I was very fortunate to meet my my still business partner. So I've known my business partner of, I've been in business with him for 20 years, but I've known him for like 35 years, let's say. Right. So met him when I was 7 years old. And we just, I was very, very tight with him and his brother. His brother, his name is Rob, and my business partner of 20 years, name is Pete Rex. And it's just wonderful to do business with someone that you have known for so long and have such a great, like, durable friendship with. So, but I didn't expect that, right? You know, growing up, it was just, I didn't know I was going to go into real estate. And actually, to answer the question, in my 20s, I was pursuing public service as my vocation. I was in an elected official for 7 years. And this whole journey happened because of 9/11, really. For me, I was like 20 years old. And so my response to that was to get involved in my local community. Also, my dad passed away. So I found myself back in my hometown unexpectedly. It's a small place. And I just kind of decided, hey, let me just grow where I'm planted. And I became an elected official. So I was elected for 7 years straight, and became basically the mayor of the town. Which,
yeah, right.
Again, I didn't expect to do. Yeah. 28 years old, mayor of the town. But concurrently with all this, thank goodness, you know, Pete and his brother Rob approached me to do small real estate investments. And we formed a partnership in our 20s. Before even the great financial crisis, we were buying 2-unit buildings, 4-unit buildings. That was going great for 2 years. And then it went terribly. The wheels completely fell off. And it was pain and misery for probably 3 to 5 years after that of just working things out. But you learn a lot as you go and as you make moves and be bold. That's really what happened to us. We just got ahead of ourselves. And I don't regret it because I learned a lot. And the small amount of friends and family money that we took in, we paid back. So that was the important part. I didn't make anything for many, many, many years. So I know how to delay marshmallows too.
feels like a similar case. We'll fast forward to today. But when did you decide to get out of public service? Like, what was that aha moment that you're like, this is not for me anymore? Because a lot of people are, you know, if you've got a passion for it, you know, like sort of being a teacher. My parents are both teachers, been in the space for a long period of time. Like, the giving back to the community is sort of a cut from the similar cloth. Was that a huge pivotal shift for you fundamentally?
Well, it was made easy for me because I got my butt whooped in an election.
Oh.
I got totally beat. And but it was fine. I was 30 years old and running for an office that was well ahead of my time to do that. One of the youngest people probably to ever run for that office. And it's a position that covered about 300,000 people. So the size of a pretty sizable city. It happened to be a county office that I was running for. And no regrets. I lost a wonderful person. He's in Congress now. So, you know, it's not like I lost to a loser. And it really opened up my whole path to pursue real estate as a full-time endeavor, as like mind, body, soul, spirit, everything into real estate, into the private sector. And I found that was my true vocation. Like, I loved my public service time and I felt very connected to my local community where I grew up. But I have zero regrets of how it worked. Yeah.
Well, you mentioned earlier, you jumped around a little bit, Tampa, Bellevue, Washington, now into Austin. So talk about that transition and how you really started to scale. So coming out of 2008, 2009, you said mentioned 3 to 5 years of pretty dark times. How did you take the company and where did you sort of, not say reinvent yourself, but really sort of start putting fuel on that fire to go and, you know, nearly $2 billion AUM.
It's a long story, but credit to Pete. Pete is my business partner. He's the founder of that firm. And I became CEO later in about 2016. But early days, I was just joining something that he had started and he was starting to get a lot of momentum. But it was still very early stage, like proof of concept deals were still happening, right? Like small deals. And so when I joined, it was kind of really forming. And I had the blessing to be in that like early part of that build out. And that's so he went to Harvard Law School in 2010. He gets out. By 2011, he's starting to do more deals. And I'm tracking all of this as I'm a
And this is in the Northeast, up near where you're from?
No, he's in Tampa.
Sorry.
Right. Yeah. And then as soon as I lose my election, I'm ready. I call them up and I'm like, I'm ready, you know, to do this thing. I had been traveling back and forth to Florida, seeing what he's up to, you know, staying in touch, and really felt the momentum and the pull that he had. He was getting great deals at crazy prices and just doing stuff you don't see anymore, and was able to raise a lot of money in that early days, which when private, you know, the capital markets were completely frozen, but he was able to, through just grit, determination, get a lot of capital for us to be able to go scale. So basically credit to him and credit to our team that he built. And I was part of that team. And like I said, I became CEO. That wasn't like in the cards when I came down to join him. It was like, I just felt like I had to earn my seat every single day and do a real good job. And I still feel that way, right? I still feel like I want my seat every day for investors, for my team, you know, everything I have. I want to like 100x the value that I'm receiving. I want 100x it for everyone else, you know?
So historically it was value-add multifamily. Are you guys divested fully today? And what does that look like? You mentioned earlier, I think you got to 2 billion, you sold 1.5, I think you mentioned, and then you started to do other stuff in and around verticals related to real estate.
Yeah. So we, in 2019, I think it sets us apart fairly well from other shops. We just felt like by the time 2019 rolled around, it was a different market than where we showed up to. When we showed up to do deals, it was quiet. No one could put them together. It was like crickets. You know, sometimes we're the first capital back into some of the neighborhoods that have been really devastated from the GFC, the financial crisis. And by 2019, it was so crowded that cap rates had compressed tremendously. So then we said to ourselves, like, every day you're not selling, you're buying. You know, you're buying again every single day. So why don't we think about maybe shift strategies, shut down the buy side and transform it into a dispo machine, lock in the returns for our investment partners and see what happens. I think that was a wise move.
100% looking back.
and then we sat around truly and we said, well, you know, this COVID was wild, right? It was completely frothy. And now we have some 2020 hindsight on that. So I think a lot of groups got in trouble buying at a very high basis and with the floating debt. But we just kind of sat it out and said, you know what, let's get greedy when the time's right. And so we feel now that 2023 was really kind of when we relaunched into real estate investment platform. That's a new platform. It's called ATX Acquisitions. But we feel like now's the time, you know, and a lot of people are saying it, but we have track record and we know we're excited. You know, we're excited to go steward people's capital and steward our own capital. And I think this is a great time to buy.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that because I think everyone's been waiting, right? You can't time the market. Time in the market is better than timing the market. I also have the same thesis that, you know, I've been investing since 2014, probably not as long as you, but had been in that early days where stuff was just crazy. You're just like, whoa, look at these cap rates compared to where they are now. I've got an opinion on the shift and the compression that we've seen, but I want to hear what your perception is in terms of, you know, the lane that is multifamily today. It's very crowded. And how are you finding opportunities in today? What makes you feel that it is the best time to be buying right now?
You know, it's a deep question. And congrats to you for all your success, man. And I love to see it. I like that you have a deal in San Antonio. It's nearby. So, but yeah, and it's, right now, what makes me feel convicted is I do feel like there has been a reset, you know? So, and some of that has to happen because the debt that you can get today is so much different from what you can get just 2 years ago. So you can't pay the same price because you just can't service that debt. So, you know, we have seen pricing come down 25-30%, mostly across the market, you know, probably depends on class A versus class C or what have you. But so that already feels good because now I feel very convicted you could buy below replacement cost. And that's one very good thing, like from a Buffett approach of real estate investment, you know, what's the intrinsic value of the asset? One way to look at that is not just your cash flows and how durable they are, but, you know, are you buying below replacement cost? So that when times are in 2019, I think a lot of deals were going like above replacement cost, which should make everyone scared. Like, well, why are people willing to pay that much money for that cash flow?
Yep. No, it's very interesting. But let's dig a little deeper on that durable cash flow, because we're also seeing the other side of the, there's obviously the pricing on just the price per pound. And I'll summarize my two cents on the, I do think the Jobs Act changed a lot in 2012 that really made the lane crowded in commercial real estate, particularly in private equity. You saw a lot of crowdfunding websites coming up. You know, it was just the advertising to the accredited investor really changed the game, and you could send out an email in 2019 and get it raised in freaking 2 weeks. You know, like it was insane, and everyone thought they needed to be. The other side of the coin is being a non-American. I think there's also been a big correlation between the value of rent to the value of the asset, right? In when you compare it to other Western worlds. And when I'm talking about that is multifamily doesn't exist in Australia. You can't go and buy 250 units. It doesn't exist in Western Europe. It doesn't really exist in Canada. And then if you look at that rental income to that value, particularly in secondary markets back in those, 2014, 2015, it was really cheap. And I think that the purchasing that durable cash flow, which I'm now going to get into my question, is that's changed a lot. So, right, cap rates are compressed, a lot more people in the lane, people jumping in the water. But now let's talk about rental rates and that durability of cash flow, because we have seen not only prices have come down on just the physical asset, but rents have really dropped off significantly. So how do you feel about rents today and where they're going versus 2 years ago when everyone had money in their pocket and the stimulus was there and people felt like they were rich?
it's great. It's great. Good stuff. And so we're in Florida and Texas. So it probably depends. Number one, where are you in the US and then even within those giant economies? So just for perspective for your audience, like Texas is the 8th largest economy in the world if it had GDP by itself.
Yep.
So that's bigger than Russia. Like, insane.
Bigger than Australia, by the way.
Yeah, there you go. And Florida used to be right neck and neck with Australia, and now Florida is like number 14 in the world, I think, for GDP, which is essentially the size of Mexico, so or thereabouts. Like it's right in there. So it's insane. And then by the way, Mexico is right there. And so these huge giant economies, and what they're seeing, especially during COVID, when interest rates were so low, right, almost like near zero, very easy to put shovels in the ground. And very easy for people to project, all right, people are going to keep moving into Florida, into Texas. And it went crazy, right? And so supply went through the roof comparatively versus like the prior 10 years. And so now you have to be very careful in how you underwrite deals. And you have to look in deeply in your submarket and understand, well, if there's a lot of supply, obviously rent's going to probably either go down or stay flat. You don't have pricing power. But I do believe that after you get through this next 18 months, let's call it, you will come back to a situation where you'll have rental pricing power. And so going back to the durability of the cash flows that you're buying, people are still going to keep moving to Texas and Florida, and they're going to keep renting because it's very hard to buy a home right now. And I don't see that changing materially because I do think we're in a higher for longer interest rate environment. So people can't afford the same mortgage that they could prior. So that's going to be a tailwind for multifamily rentals. I think a lot of household formation is going to get forced to go into rental until something else changes, until we build more homes or interest rates go down for mortgages.
Hey guys, I just want to take a second to share with you our latest multifamily investment opportunity, the Broadwater at Salado Creek, located in San Antonio, Texas, the market where we've got the most experience in. Now, rapid fire, here are the reasons why we love this deal. It's got fantastic investor returns. We are projecting around 20% annualized investor returns for those people who choose to invest in this deal. The second thing is that all the 176 units are in classic condition, which means we can come in, use our renovation program, and push rents even higher. Thirdly, is that multifamily pricing for properties have fallen more today than they did during the 2008 global financial crisis. This could very well be the best time in the commercial real estate cycle to pick up cheap deals. Now, if you're interested, click in the description or reach out to me directly at reed@rsnpropertygroup.com. Now, let's get back into the episode. Yep. No, it's very interesting. Are you looking at any type of vintage, like 2000 and newer? Like, where are you bullish right now as you're starting to dip your toe back in the lane, so to speak?
The deals we've done so far are pretty much value add 1980s, but especially we like to look for like a light value add, a deal that's been run well. It's not a huge turnaround situation. That's ideal because it's just easier. I don't think you get paid as well for the value add
The deep value add, you mean?
The deep value add. Yeah, exactly. So I think, 80s and newer would be a cutoff unless something is really amazing from a location standpoint. We'll look at 70s. But yeah, 80s and newer, my dream deal right now would be like a out of development lease up. You know, it's 90%, so you can get agency debt and you just buy it below replacement cost because they built it expecting to exit a lower cap rate than they can get today. They can't get it, right? So you buy that below replacement cost, but those I haven't seen us be competitive on those quite yet.
Yeah, well, the deal we've got tied up in San Antonio is like $107 a foot on the total purchase. Like, it's just, I'm building a new build for rent in San Marcos at, you know, $230-$250 a square foot. So it's right. It's, you know, the replacement cost is real, but it's also the function of rent. So how are you looking at demographics these days? You talk about the inflows into Texas and the fundamentals, I guess, there of multi. People are going to continue to rent. How do you see the average renter, particularly the blue collar, being affected, and how has that changed? Has that persuaded your investment thesis coming back into the game in 23-24?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, every year is different, probably, you know, I would have to say, because especially we look at rent to median income in the area, because if you've already had, like, think about during COVID, right? A lot of areas had 20% rent growth or wild in 1 year. So trade outs is, and people took it and they were paying it. So how much more can their wallet share actually take on? Like, there's a breaking point there where people, if their wage growth is going like this, but rent growth is going like that, you know, and it's outpacing it, that's not sustainable, because eventually that's going to have to even out, because people, you know, they have other needs. They have healthcare, they have groceries, they have, you know, they have cars, and they have to get to work, whatever. So I think we have to be very, very cognizant of that. And that's why, you know, we only invest in Florida and Texas, because I do believe after we get through the supply, the glut of supply coming, that people are going to keep moving here. And by the way, immigration is a story that is probably not told enough right now. And not taking politics aside, right? Just look at the Congressional Budget Office recently put out that 3.8 million increase in population in the U.S. in 2023, the largest increase ever. But guess what? Only 500,000 was from natural, you know, births outpacing deaths. 500,000. So the U.S. is not really growing that much. You know, on a large population, that's such a small number. So 3.3 million are immigrants.
Yep. And no, it's I'm one of them, right? You know.
Yeah. Welcome, man. I love that you're here, and I love that you're creating jobs, man. You're mixing it up. You're a capitalist.
And right. But that, and that's it's such a interesting point that you know most Western countries, you need inflow because the death rate versus the birth rate is declining. We just mentioned that on the Green Room about how many kids you've got. You know, like that. For every I can't remember the stat, but yeah, you need skilled migrants coming into the country, you know, again, politics aside, but that also stimulates, they need a house, they need mortgages, they need shops, they need food, they need healthcare. Like there's other stimulants around it. So it's, and that's not going to stop, right? Like, as the American dream is still the American dream from a lot of expats like myself to make a buck, to make a name for yourself and all that sort of good stuff. Because at the end of the day, we all want the same thing, right? That's to have a better life. So, so back to the, so do you see wages for the middle income, low income folk, you know, who it sounds like we're renting the same sort of folks. Do you see that continuing, and do you still keep that third of that income as like the buffer to say, you know, no more than a third can be spent on rent. Thus, we want to back into certain rental growth.
Yeah, that is a good buffer. We look at that for sure. And anytime we're bumping above a third of the wallet share, you get scared because, like, yeah, you can pencil $400 rent bumps, but can people pay for it? You know, it's and it depends on your market too. Like, you know, famously Miami might be like 50% wallet share, and people pay it. You know, it's wild.
Or New York or San Francisco.
Yeah, New York. Yeah, yeah. So yeah, we are very cognizant of that, and we try to be very careful of that. Also, I think another demographic thing is remote work as part of the demographic shift in the U.S. I think has been we've almost forgotten about it nowadays, and it's been written about less. But we are now four times more likely to work from home, and as versus pre-COVID. So that, and I think that's a durable thing. So, you know, people try to say, hey, well, it was already on the uptick before COVID, fine, but now it's 4x more. So it's a step change in how people are living. And so now they're able to work in more suburban environments and be less connected to the city core, especially if they have to come in once or twice a week, or even not at all. So I think that's going to favor the suburbs for the next 10 years. And it's going to favor large floor plans that are family friendly. So we kind of have been looking into that recently as well. We have 2 bedrooms, 3 bedrooms. We looked at one deal, got very close on it. It was all 3 bedrooms, townhomes. That's a cool floor plan for me because that can really stand out in the market. And you get the amenities of and all the maintenance and benefits of living in a big multifamily deal versus renting in a house, a single family rental, you know? So some people are going to select that in a market, and there's not that many that got built like that. A lot of it's just maximizing square foot, you know, price per square foot, which is studios and ones and twos. So
how do you see the sub $50,000 income demographic, and they might not be able to work from home? Like they're more the service-based workers. Do you see any thoughts on that as it relates to that comment around working remotely?
That's a good point, because they have to be where the service jobs are, which I think are still probably going to be, you know, they're spread out. But I don't know, you know, I think they're going to have a little bit of wage growth, pricing power vis-a-vis other segments of the population. At least I've read that. So I think they're in a somewhat of a healthy position coming out of COVID, with people coming back and the economy still chugging along in the U.S. Like it's surprisingly been very durable. And I think that's actually been an updraft for the workforce, like that workforce housing type of renter. I believe they've done fairly well in terms of wage growth vis-a-vis the higher end, you know, more white collar people.
Yeah, no, the people that I listen to, I'm not the expert, you know, saying that there's more instability in the higher end working environment than, you know, the services. But yet those service-based renters feel the inflationary effects the most, right? So it's, you know, we have seen across, I'm sure your portfolio as well, like delinquency has, you know, the last 18 months has been pretty freaking high. It's starting to come down now, but that is a reflection of how the economy is facing higher prices. Not everyone, we're all paying the same at the gas pump. We're all paying the same for a loaf of bread. And depending on your income, you know, it's going to hurt you more, right? So I've been saying for longer that we've been in more of a slower economy. I don't want to say maybe a recessionary economy, just based on the data we're getting from our renters who are in that workforce blue collar zone. And it's more than what's been probably let on in the press. And I know at least our rental housing's come down in pricing. So on the CPI reader, I don't know how they're measuring it, but it's like you come look at my portfolio, I can show you there's been massive rent declines, you know, in the last 24 months. So yeah.
And these folks are renters by not by choice but necessity.
Correct.
So and they're more on edge, you know, which is really a sad state of affairs in the U.S. Such a wealthy country. And yet people, if they have one medical emergency or a bill that can destroy all, they have no savings, and that destroys their ability to pay rent just in one thing happening in their life. It's a crazy, crazy thing.
Dan, I want to pivot a little bit, and as we wind up the end of the show here, talk to us a little bit about your technology platforms that you've built and how has that been from a real estate private equity firm to technology and you know, I know you also do property management, which is very aligned and makes sense. But talk to me about the technology piece of it, because that, to some investors, they'd be like, what are you doing? You're a brick and mortar guy. Like, what are you doing screwing around with SaaS?
Right, for sure. No, we've heard that too. But, you know, me personally, by the way, I'm very focused on our property operations, which is ResProp and real estate investment. I am a partner in the Rex technology stuff. And in the past, I've helped ideate and build some things there, you know, build the teams that build it. But you know, I think what we're building at the very top of it is a very visionary, long-term 20, 30 year idea. So we look at it like an ecosystem. Like the first part is operations, that's property management. It's a very people heavy, that's super people heavy, right? So, and it's spread out. It's a distributed workforce. And then we have real estate investments that can be a very small team doing a lot of volume, because a really small team with excellence can do billions of dollars of deals over time. But then the technology platform is something that we conceived of it because we know real estate has been a laggard, number one. It's the largest asset class in the world by far, bigger than the stock market and bigger than every other asset class, right? So, but it's been a laggard in how it takes on and adopts technology. There's many reasons for that. So construction technology and real estate technology has been far behind other sectors of the economy. So we feel like there's opportunity there. And then we feel like it's a huge way to serve people. So tech can be scaled in ways that property operations and real estate investment just can't do. Like if you build a great tech product, you can be in millions of homes or millions of square feet of office or whatever. So you can have a bigger impact on the world. So basically that's how we conceive of it. Like, and for our shareholders, it should really, one synergizes the other. So our shareholders in the immediate short term might say, well, are you distracted? But in the long term, we want to tell them, hey, we're going to have a secret sauce in our company, in our ecosystem of companies, because we're looking at things from a bleeding edge tech perspective. The world is changing every day, and that impacts how real estate investments happen and how property operations happen. So if we gain little edges over time by efficiency, by better strategy, by being so thoughtful about all these different the three key aspects of the real estate world, I think we're going to have alpha over time.
I love that about wealth is created through, in my opinion, ecosystem, business ecosystems. It's, I've been doing this for a decade, this podcast, and spoken to many different people about how they've picked up ideas, that the core nucleus around real estate investing, but they're creating the property management, creating the construction firm, creating some technology platforms on top of it to not only reduce cost, but to reduce risk, really also drives the wealth creation for the investors who maybe backed you in the beginning and having those conversations like why are you being distracted? It's like, well, actually, no, this is why. And when you can explain it with thought and passion, and how it fits into the puzzle pieces is key, right? Because that's how they say, Dan, I trust you. Go nuts. So, yeah. But, mate, at the end of every show, we do like to dive into the top five investing tips. But before we do it, 30 seconds, what is the next 12 to 18 months look for you in terms of the buying opportunity, in terms of, do you think we're at the bottom? And what's the company, sort of focused on in that next short period of time?
Yeah, like I said, we going back to the Buffett approach applied to real estate, like let's get greedy because other people are fearful and there's still a lot of groups that are on the sidelines, they're off balance, and they're not sure what to do with how to look at deals. And we feel convicted, right? So let's get greedy now. That doesn't mean get deal heat, and it doesn't mean do stupid things and just do any deal, but like let's get greedy because I do believe that pricing is probably near its bottom. So Let's go. Let's lock in the deals now, run them extremely well. And in two to three years, we're going to have different opportunities to refi, consider long-term holds. And so lock them in now. They're harder to do, but that's when you make more money.
Are you doing floating rate or are you doing fixed rate debt?
It's all fixed.
I think the big thing to our investors is like, guys, you may have fixed and flipped a couple of deals and we've done that and done well, but like you're going back to fundamentals of you're going to go for the full hog, meaning if it's a 5-year business term, you're probably going for 5 years. Like there's none of this like flipping out of it in 2.5 and doubling someone's money. And I think that a readjustment to sort of the fundamentals of what real estate is, which is a medium to long-term investment and shouldn't be treated like a stock and quickly right. Flipping in and out. Like I think that has changed fundamentally in telling investors, you're year three, you're gonna sell? And you're like, guys, no, this is a 5 years fixed. Like we're not gonna sell. Be in it for the long term and understand that going in. So I think that's also a conversation to be had, not only how you buy deals, but how you market it to investors. So I can't wait to continue to see you guys grow and get you back on here in a year's time. We can have another conversation. But with that being said, we love to dive in the top five investing tips. You ready to get into it?
Let's do it.
Mate, question number one, what is a daily habit you practice to keep on track towards your goals?
Oh gosh. I'm very particular about my calendar. I don't allow myself to get wrapped into meetings that aren't creating value. So I'm constantly just trying to be thoughtful about how I spend my time. That's my biggest hack, I think.
Do you do time blocking at all? Like just don't like put stuff on the calendar that no one can book and they can't interrupt your day, so to speak.
Really, I take my mornings typically to do that, where it's like, you know, it's ahead of the game. I wake up, get my kids on the bus, and then I have like a couple hours where people are just not hitting me. And there's nothing ever scheduled during that time. So I use that time to kind of think, get my mind together, and work on some deeper level or deep flow kind of projects that I have. So I'll do that.
Question number two is, who's been the most influential person in your career to date?
You know, it's got to be my partner, Pete Rex. It's really nice to be partnered with someone who you admire, you know, and really you want to step up because, I know he's very good. He's just all around. He's on it. Created a lot of wealth, but that didn't slow him down. And he's even more into the mission, more into building. So I love that. I love being kind of like that. You need a workout partner, basically. Otherwise, you're going to sit around the gym and just hang out and you're never going to build muscle, you know? So I think he's a great, great workout partner, and if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, love it. Love that analogy. Question number three, what is the most influential tool in your business? And when I say a tool, it could be a physical tool like a journal or a phone, or it could be a piece of software that you just can't run the business without. What is it?
Look, it's team, because, and I just wrote about this today on LinkedIn, but, you know, strength in numbers, like the pack, the wolf pack, like that's super important, because otherwise you're kind of limited. If you're on your own and you're a really truly solopreneur or whatever, it's limited what you can truly do. And I love teaming. I love like someone else's skills I'll never have. I'll never really be able to develop them, because you only get one life. Can't be good at everything. So I love teaming. So I think I would say team.
Yeah, I good answer. Love it. We could talk about a whole podcast episode on team and building culture and all that good stuff. Question number four is, in one sentence, what's been the biggest failure in your career? And what did you learn from that failure?
It's the whole irrational exuberance that I allowed myself to get wrapped into prior to the GFC, which in some ways, I'm glad it happened, because it got me into real estate. But, it was such a dumb way to think about real estate. Like, it's always going to go up. So it's just get your hand on some real estate now, before, almost like, infomercial type mentality of investing. Like, hey, just quick before everyone else buys it. Super dumb. So, but luckily I got that experience early on my own money and my own pain. So I didn't have to learn that advice, that lesson through other people's money. You know?
Yeah, no, 100%. We're seeing that price readjustment right now is real multifamily, and there's people hurting today. Deals are being handed back to the bank, and we could again talk about that. Like it's a bit of a 2008 moment in some of the multi and office space investments, and yeah, people are feeling the pain. So it's a good time to be greedy, but you know, if you've been in the game long enough, some people have got some scars coming up. So anyway, mate, last question is, where can people reach you to continue the conversation? They want to be in your sphere. Where do they go?
I give out my phone number. Sure. You know, some people have hit me up before off podcast, so it's kind of cool. 845-629-1808 and atxacquisitions.com. You'll see some of our investment approach and our team and our track record and some deals we have out, because they're all 506C deals. And LinkedIn is cool too. You know, if anyone wants to hit me up on LinkedIn, I'm most active there. That's pretty much my social channel.
Well, look, thank you. I want to thank you so much for jumping on today's show. I just want to reflect some of the things that I took away. I think it's the lessons you learned, as you mentioned, in that failure about like being too thinking around real estate is always going to go up, and going through that early pain has really helped you set a level head for creating a business which is around an ecosystem of growth. But I also truly agree with the fundamental of this conversation. It's around, it is a really, really great time to be buying right now. Like, don't just take it from me. Listen to Dan, listen to others, listen to other people who are actually out in the market buying deals today, because there has been a price adjustment. So go see that. Understand also the demographics and the fundamentals behind the growth of why it still continues to be a very, very, very good investment for the medium to long-term hold. And just understand the fundamentals that are driving the US economy. You know, just mentioning that Texas is bigger than Russia, I think you mentioned, is also bigger than Australia in terms of GDP. Same with Florida. So the US is the behemoth of GDP growth, and trying to just hitch your trailer to that as it continues to grow. So, right. Mate, did I leave anything out there?
No, you nailed it. It's been a pleasure, man.
Awesome, brother. Well, look, I want to thank you again for taking some time out of your day to jump on today's show, and we'll catch you next time, and enjoy the rest of your week.
I look forward to it. Thanks, Reed.
Well, there you have another cracking episode jam-packed with some incredible stuff from Dan. Remember, if you want to check him out, go to atxacquisitions.com. It's Dan French on LinkedIn. And if you have any questions for him, make sure you're checking him out and everything that he's doing in his ecosystem. I want to thank you all again for taking some time out of your day to tune in to continue to grow your financial IQ. It's the easiest way to give back to this show is to give it a 5-star review on iTunes. We're going to do this all again next week. So remember, be bold, be brave, and go give life a crack.